So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with The Modern Man, the monthly magazine show for your ears. Here's what we've got coming up for you today.
They want to kill the snake because, you know, that's what they would normally do. I've got to save the snake. I've got to get out of here. And I just run.
With more snakes than ever in the UK, who are you going to call? I meet the man from South Wales whom it's useful to keep on your speed dial. Plus,
I felt really unwell. The last freaking thing I felt like doing was shoving a tube inside my vagina.
Alex Fox on how cancer treatment can impact your sex life, and Ollie Peart takes to the sea. That's all to come on this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters, and hello to longtime Man fan Luke Drinkwater, who particularly enjoyed listening to Ollie adulterating a 1980s Philips AM/FM radio last month in the Zeitgeist. He says, tinkering with electronics resonates with me because I work backstage in theatre, and one of my favourite aspects of my job is making and fixing what we call practicals. What we call practicals in the theatrical trade, darling. If you're not familiar with the roar of the grease paint, that might be a new one for you. Practicals. He says practicals are props or part of the set made to be controlled electrically or electronically from offstage. Electrically or electronically. What's the difference? I don't know. Some examples which I've worked on include a reverse radio, an old analog radio with an RF receiver in it so that sound cues can be played back through it. Model houses with tiny lights in them, with batteries and wireless DMX receivers so that they can be controlled by the lighting desk, and a Hornby train with the wheels swapped out for Lego train wheels to allow it to run on a Lego track, controlled by a remote control car controller with lights and a tiny smoke machine in it to make it puff steam, which again, were made to be controlled from the lighting desk. I can hear your excitement, Luke. You can probably hear my slight indifference. I can tell you, producer Matt will be salivating at this. If you could have a dream job for Matt that didn't involve making podcasts, it would be your job and or making podcasts about your job, Luke. For my part, if you made a YouTube series about your job working in theatrical props, I would absentmindedly flick through it and enjoy that time. Hello as well to David, who says, Ollie, thanks so much for making me Mambassador for Concord. It caught me completely off guard, and I am almost embarrassed to admit how excited I got. You're welcome, David, although you don't then detail exactly how excited you did get. I can only presume it involved a ticker tape parade through the streets of Concord. Remember, if like David, you would like to be a Mambassador, sort of closetly you've always wanted to be a Mambassador. I mean, I had to out David. He didn't even ask. I found his details in our PayPal records. But if you would like to be a Mambassador, we've run out of shout-out requests, so now's a good time to email us. But do buy us a beer first. All the links are on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. It's amazing to bring the listeners of the world together through this show. It's also amazing to have your support because we are a completely independent podcast. We make this for you because we believe in it. No one is funding us to do this apart from you and the ads that you can hear. If you'd buy me a beer if you met me in person, then please do buy me a digital beer, preferably every month if you can. That is how we fund the show. That is how we make this show. We need your support. You can use PayPal or Stripe. There are links on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, and then click Beer Money. You can also click Mambassadors to see the current state of the Mambassador map. Thank you. And this is your advance notice. Whoop, 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 whoop. what? What's that? It's the dad siren. It's your advance notice that next month will be our annual How to Be a Dad episode. Tom will be here, Stu will be here, and the three of us will be talking about our kids for the 9th year running, extraordinarily. If you have a question that you would like us to answer, if you have a subject you'd like to hear us talk about when it comes to raising small children, perhaps you have tips yourself about bringing up an 8-year-old boy, which we all have, then do get in touch. Click the feedback form on our website. But we are recording that this Thursday, 13th of July. So get those questions for us in now. And apologies to those of you listening in the future who cannot do that. I've wasted your time for the last 30 seconds. Right, coming up today, you will learn which product category is now available in dark skin tone. You'll learn what 13 million adults in the UK have done. And you'll learn the most comfortable way to transport a snake. Let's go. Time for the Zeitgeist, your trends tested with Ollie Peart.
Hey, Ollie. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay, thank you. Yes, I caught the sun today.
I can tell. I mean, you've really caught it, haven't you?
How are you?
I've just been doing what everybody else has been doing, and I've been on Threads.
What's it like? I can't believe I'm saying that. That will sound so basic to anyone in the future, but I haven't been able to check it out yet.
It looks identical to Twitter, but apart from people kind of, I don't know, arguing about politics and all that kind of stuff, it's just people asking what the best way to cut a cucumber is.
Like original Twitter?
Like original Twitter. It feels like original Twitter. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's quite an appealing concept in a way.
It is.
I've got this thing. I don't know if other people feel like this. I always just feel respect to the OG a little bit.
Mm.
Like Twitter was my microblogging platform in 2009. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
And I just feel like I remember that. Mm. I don't like Elon Musk. I understand why people want to leave. But a bit like I've never left Spotify, even though Apple Music and Amazon Music came along and they're probably both fine. I was just like, well, Spotify is where I was. They did it first. I still Skype. I get in early and I stay.
Wait, hang on. You still Skype?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
Who are you Skyping? It doesn't even happen. But I kind of know what you mean. But yeah, I don't know. It just, I think what they've done is they've created something that looks so familiar that actually transferring from Twitter, if that is a platform that you're used to and use all the time, actually, it's not that big a jump because it's basically identical.
Well, that's enough of that. I'll hit you up on ICQ later. We'll talk about it in detail. Last month, Manfan George in Devon tasked you, Ollie Peart, with investigating whether or not his anecdotal evidence that more people seem to be playing around with boats is an actual statistical trend. Mm-hmm. And he also challenged you to learn some water sports. How has it gone?
So, I have learnt how to e-foil.
Excellent. I've no idea what that is. It sounds like a hack for a microwave.
It is an electric hydrofoil. So a hydrofoil is essentially a wing that goes under the water and then whatever sort of, I don't know, boat or board or whatever is sort of attached to the top of that wing. So it's like got a beam underneath and then the wing sits underneath the water and the boat, if you like, floats above the water.
I see.
It means is the actual boat or board isn't bouncing on the waves or the water. The wing instead is under the water, so you get this sort of smooth ride. And the invention of them, of a hydrofoil, was like, I don't know, 1890 something. So it's old.
So what were they powered by before then?
Just normal motors.
How did the Victorians have a motor in it? They have a horse on the top.
And the original one, I believe, was powered by paddle.
Right.
Like steam paddle, maybe.
Yeah, okay.
Something like that. But the reason I wanted to try it is because I actually saw a video of a couple of guys riding around on one of these things. I didn't actually know what they were at the time. And it was like, well, you know how much I love board sports. They were just sort of carving through the water in like what seemed like the most smooth, slickest, weirdest looking thing I'd ever seen. I'd never sort of seen anything like it.
So this is an individual sport then, is it? It's like, you know, kite surfing or surfboarding or whatever. You're standing by yourself, are you, on the e-foil? You can't bring people with you or a case of drinks or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You can get hydrofoil boats, which are like, you know, they've got lots of different things on. But an e-foil, no. Like, it's just for one person.
Okay, I'm struggling to kind of... It's difficult because I haven't seen a picture of one, but I'm just trying to understand the physics of that. You know, the resistance of the water against the thing underneath it, you would think would slow it down. Like, that's the whole point of having a sail above, isn't it? Or in the case of like a hovercraft or something, actually boosting yourself above the water so you don't encounter that resistance. Doesn't it go really slowly?
Well, no, because it's cutting through the water, so it's very, very thin. And the feel of this wing was unbelievable. The company that made the board that I use, they're actually called Flight, from Australia.
Do they have a trendy spelling? I bet they do. Let me guess. F-L-Y-T-E.
Ooh, F-L-I-T-E.
F-L-I-T-E. Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't go for the Y. Yeah. Which I quite like.
That's how my son would spell Flight if we were playing the BFG game.
Yeah. Part of me is just like, just spell it correctly.
Yeah.
But they've machined this out of one piece of, I think they call it like aircraft grade aluminium.
Nice.
You know, like it's like.
Because you're not just an e-foiler, you're a captain. Right. How long did it take you to learn to be the pilot of this e-foiler?
First of all, you have to get the thing to the water. Now, these are battery powered. And they're quite big and they're very powerful. And the battery is very, very heavy. You can actually get a foil board, which you can put a sail on it or a kite board. You know, kite boarding.
Yeah.
You can get these with that. So they're not powered by electric or anything like that. These things obviously have got the battery inside the board. So they're very, very heavy. So you have to... I was actually riding the thing in sandbanks in Poole. So it's not too far from where I am. And I had to walk it with the instructor down to the beach. And it is so heavy.
And when you say with the instructor, did it take two of you then to carry it?
Well, in all fairness, he did carry it most of the way, but
he was your Sherpa.
He was like twice my size.
Okay.
Yeah, in height and like girth.
Girth. It's just not a word you ever hear outside of penis size, girth. Thank you for mentioning it in any other context.
But he was just quite girth.
No, girth.
But then once you get it in the water, it literally is just the board just kind of floats in the water and you have this little trigger, like a little gun, and it's got a little display on it. And you pull the trigger with your finger and that means go, and you let go and that means stop. It's not like a Scalextrics, which I thought
comparison.
It was.
Yeah, yeah.
He goes, it's not an accelerator. It's either go or stop, right?
So the power of your finger movement makes no difference to the speed?
No.
Okay.
No, it's either on or off.
Right.
The way you control the speed is there's a plus or minus button on the controller. And I was a bit like, I'm not sure why you would do it like that. Why not have it as a throttle? I think the reason is because of the way that you ride it, it is quite difficult. And there is a strong chance that you would accidentally just squeeze and then you'd just go flying. Yeah. Honestly, because you're so, like, the first time you get on it, you're like, ah! So you're sort of like, you're just squeezing, so you go 100 miles an hour. There's 20 speeds on it, so it goes from 1 to 20.
Wow.
And he said, right, we'll start you off on 1, just lie on the board, right, and we'll go out to that
lie
boy
down
over
on
there.
The board. So like you're surfing, right, so you're on your front.
Yeah, yeah. But on 1, you're not going out of the water, so as you go faster... The foil sort of takes you out above the water on the board, but you don't. At 1, you're just splashing in the waves and you're kind of, you know, and I was just on my tummy. And it was just to get out to the boys so we weren't going to mow anybody down or anything like that. And he said, then we'll start you on 4. We'll try 4 and you're just going to be on your knees. And we went on 4 and it is the most surreal feeling. You're sort of, you're bouncing on the water like you would be on a boat and you're going, it feels kind of fast. I don't know how fast I was going, but it feels kind of fast. And then occasionally you'll hit a wave and then you'll feel yourself sort of float above the water and then it's like nothing. It's like you're flying. And I'm not joking. It genuinely feels like you're flying. It's so surreal. If you go over a wave on one of these things and the board's not touching the water, you do not feel it at all. And at this point, I'm only on my knees, remember, and it's only 4, so it's quite slow. So what you actually do is you sort of bounce and hit a wave. And then you float, and then you bounce and hit a wave. And he's like, right, let's get you to stand up now. We're going to try standing up. And that's when it got quite hairy and it was really difficult. And you have to go faster. So he was like, we're going to take you up to 7. And I was standing up. And it is honestly terrifying and brilliant in equal measure because it starts to lift out the water. And if you get your weight wrong, the nose will go up or it will go down. Because the wing is right at the back of the board. And if it goes down, obviously you plunge into the water and you go flying. And if it goes up, you basically fly out of the water and you go flying. And it was so fast. I mean, it felt so fast. And I never got above 7. Remember, these things goes up to 20.
Did you fall off, though?
Yeah, oh, God, yeah.
Right. So what, in that scenario, what happens
times.
Is because you've let go of the trigger, I guess that cuts the engine, does it?
Yeah, the minute you let go of it,
the
engine cuts. I mean, even if you're squeezing it, I think it's got some kind of accelerometer in it that it knows you're falling, so it just cuts the engine.
Oh,
off.
That's good. So it's not like the boat then goes miles away from you.
No,
quite easily.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What you've got to remember though is if you're on like 7, which is quite fast, and you accidentally let go of the thing, it doesn't gradually slow down. it basically stops, so you then just go flying. So you have to kind of just like slow it down. But when you're at that speed and you're sort of going above the water, you're almost a meter above the water.
Oh, that's
on this
cool.
thing. Yeah, and you're like floating around. And I can honestly say, it is one of the best water sports I've ever done. Like, it was absolutely unbelievable. It feels like nothing else. You cannot, I mean, I can try and explain it to you. I've explained it like it's a bit like flying and that kind of stuff, but you will genuinely never know what it's like unless you do it. It is so good.
So, statistically yes. then, is George and Devon correct that more people are playing around with boats?
Yes and no, actually, because of COVID, right? Obviously, lots of people stopped doing water sports and whatnot. So when the restrictions were lifted, more people stayed at home and started doing more water sports. And the other reason that he might have noticed more people going out there is we've had some stellar summers recently.
Oh, that,
We've had some really amazing weather over the summer. So there are some stats from the water sports survey. There is an annual water sports survey. And compared to 2021 and 2022, there hasn't been much of a rise. So there are around 13 million adults in the UK that have done some kind of boating.
Because it's interesting, isn't it? I hadn't really thought about it like that. But I suppose theoretically, if climate change goes the way that everyone thinks it is, then in 30 years' time, you know, it'll be like being in a Greek island, won't it? You'll have people on banana boats around Southend, presumably, is the idea.
Yeah, yeah. And but the thing is, it is a bit of a mixed picture as well. So things like paddleboarding, right? There's been a massive increase in people paddleboarding. And actually, that's shown in the figures of the number of people that have been saved by the RNLI. Mm. So in 2016, three people were rescued on paddleboards. And then last year, it was 89. So more and more people are getting into paddleboarding, but there are also more and more people getting into trouble.
E-foiling, then, how much are they? Like, can anyone buy one?
They start at around €10,000.
Sheesh.
Yeah,
and you can't
it's a
just
lot of money.
Keep it anywhere, presumably. Are you supposed to keep it in your garage? What's the deal?
I mean, you could keep it in your garage, yeah.
But you can't moor it, right?
You take it out of the water, yeah.
Yeah. So it's
the kind
of
thing you can pack it. You could pack it in the back of your car, and you could go to a lake or whatever, and you could ride around or the sea. Yeah.
So people who aren't podcaster Ollie Pitt, can they just get in touch with their local e-foil centre and do what you did or not?
Yeah, exactly. So the company that I went to was actually called Easy Riders.
I'm gonna guess E-A-Z-Y.
No, it wasn't. No. It was spelled normal.
Oh.
It was spelled the normal way. Because flight, they wanted to obviously put me on a board as quickly as possible. And this is how trendy it is, Ollie. They were like, I've got to take all our stuff down to Portugal because Google are doing a thing down there and they're getting all their staff on our kit. So the Google staff are hanging around in Portugal in their kit. So he knew this school, Easy Riders in Poole, and he said, go to them and they do lessons and they've got a couple of these things and you can try them out. So that's where I went. And there are a couple of places that can do it.
How much is it?
It's 250 quid.
Oh, Christ. Okay. For how long?
That's 2 hours, one-on-one private tuition, which I think you will need. But it's also the thing is, it's really tough on your legs. There's no way I could last a full 2 hours. I lasted about an hour, so I don't know you could do it unless you got really strong legs. 2 hours might be a bit much.
Well, after that surprising success, Ollie Pitt, and you've come back injury free, would you like to know what your challenge is for next month?
It's unfair, but yes.
What? I said...
You're surprising success. I mean, come on. I'm successful like 40% of the time. Come on.
Okay. Your challenge for next month comes from Scott, who says, Ollie, my friend is really into looks maxing.
Right.
And I think he's actually seen some benefit from it. Could Ollie please look into what it involves and give it a try? Any ideas, Mr. Pitt? Looks maxing.
No. I don't know what it is.
Sounds like a TikToker on how to do TK Maxx best, doesn't it? But what it is kind of advice to... he's linked to a video which is called How Looks Maxing Can Improve Your Appearance in 30 Days.
Okay, so like a cream or a, I don't know, tablets?
It's hacks, it's tips, it's exercises, some of them not the ones you're expecting... And it appears to be a thing that young people, but young men in particular, are getting increasingly obsessed with.
So it's like it's life hacks for looks. So it's the ways to make yourself look. So what? Just, I mean, that's just beauty therapy,
well,
isn't
let's
it,
find or... out if by trying looks maxing for 30 days you can improve your appearance. What do you think needs to be improved, Ollie?
Well, I just think it's hard to improve perfection.
Right.
I mean, how do you... Where do you even begin?
Where do you
know
begin?
What I mean?
That's it.
Where do you begin?
Yeah.
It's you look at one part, you're like, well, don't need to bother with that. Don't need to touch that. I would change my wonky nostrils. I've got one nostril bigger than the other.
You have got a wonky nostril. I've never noticed that until you've just flared them at me.
I would change that. And I don't know how it happened. I don't know if I got bashed in the face as a kid.
If you find an exercise through investigating looks maxing for invigorating a wonky nostril, I would be delighted to share that with the world.
Just breathe through your one nostril for 17 days.
Good. Are you up for that? Are you up for investigating the looks maxing community?
I can always try and look better, Ollie. I'll see what I can do. Can't promise anything. I mean, when the package is this lovely...
If you've got a trend you would like to put to Ollie to investigate on the next edition of the show, then do fill out the feedback form on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. Coming up next, the adventure continues. You will meet Dr. Rhys Jones. But first, music time, and this is Jamie Webster with his new single, Voice of the Voiceless. It's out now.
I can't speak. I can't dream. I can't change it so you see the world like me. But there's a pulse, so still I try to feel a beat in the city where the streets in the city they're all flying out tonight. Can you hear the voice of the voiceless? Can you see a choice for the choiceless? It's on the wall. Can you hear the call to make a noise for the noiseless? Can you hear the voice of the voiceless?
Now, did you know that there are three types of snakes native to Britain? Or that the UK is home to 700,000 pet snakes? Or that the RSPCA this summer has announced that calls to its snake hotline are at an all-time high? Well, one man who definitely knows all of that is Dr. Rhys Jones. He's a lecturer and reptile specialist at the University of Cardiff. And in this feature you're about to hear, he tells me about some of his international adventures rescuing snakes and what to do if you see one in your backyard. But first, as ever on this show, a little bit about his life. Born to a single mum who was only 18 when she had him, Rhys was brought up on a council estate and always loved wildlife, both on trips with his mum to the Drope, a local beauty spot, and also thanks to his favourite book, The Ladybird Book of Dinosaurs, which young Rhys, an avid reader, carried round with him everywhere. Yet his path into academic zoology was far from a sure thing.
You know, my first day in school, I can remember vividly the teacher there with one of these A1 flip pads, and she's writing... You know, doing a little picture of like a cat, and underneath C-A-T, cat. And then there's a house, and roof. And I was, this is hysterical. I am so far ahead of all these children in reading, and, you know, I'm going to fly this. And within a month, I was behind.
And that was because you were dyslexic, but you didn't know that then.
Oh, we had, you know, not only did I not know I was dyslexic, I don't think, you know, it was even thought of in school or recognised at that time. And so I was struggling to understand why it was that all of my classmates seemed to put in very little work and yet could just sail past me academically. And I was putting in all these hours trying to, you know, read and write, and I just wasn't quite making the grade. You dreaded when somebody turned, you know, when I can remember Miss Laurie, lovely, lovely lady, lovely lady. But, you know, her classes filled me with dread. You know, she'd turn around and say, okay, Rhys, could you read the next paragraph, please? Those words, utter dread. And it just seemed as if I was there hours reading that paragraph. Mm. And the relief felt when she'd say, thank you, Richard, could you read the next paragraph? Because you knew the rest of that day you weren't going to be asked again. So I despised education. I couldn't wait to get out. My mother, she used to take me down to a little place called the Drope, And it was this wonderful place. Not many people went there. So you had these big open fields. And, you know, when we went there, it was just like just us there. It was just wonderful. Mm. And there was this little tributary, a little sort of feeder stream that went through to the big River Ely, big, big river there. And I can remember my grandmother, you know, we used to go down on a Sunday afternoon. And my grandmother would always make sure if we're going out, we've got to be well fed. So we'd have a big Sunday lunch. And of course, if you've eaten that much, you start to feel really, really drowsy. And I can remember that day in particular, we started to go down to the Drope and it was the hottest day of the year. And my mother said, what do you want to do? And I said, can I just be honest? I just want to go sit under a tree and have a little snooze, you know, let this food go down because I'm not feeling too good. So I walked off to the little beach next to this tiny little stream and I found an old willow tree and I sat under there and I was just reading my book. And you know what it's like when you're hearing a tributary, you can hear the water sort of gurgling past, you can hear the mosquitoes buzzing around your head. And it all becomes very atmospheric and it all becomes very hypnotic. And slowly, slowly, I just drifted off to sleep. It was gone. And it was while I was absolutely fast asleep, it was almost like a dream where you could hear this sort of, feel this rustling and this rolling. And I didn't know quite what it was about. And then all of a sudden, I felt this wet tongue hit my leg. Because I had a pair of shorts on, so it hit my, you know, my bare skin. I literally jumped out of my skin, panicking as most, you know, if you just woken up, you're quite trying to assess what goes on. Remember, I'm 8 years old here, so I'm a small kid. And I look down, and on my foot is a female grass snake, the biggest female grass snake, I think, you know, obviously I'd ever seen in my life at that point, but still to this day, one of the biggest.
But so how long's that?
We're looking at about 1.2 metres in length.
Okay.
This is a huge snake.
Right. I was thinking a foot.
Oh, no. This is huge. And I panicked. What is this animal? Am I in danger? This is a snake. Do we have snakes in Wales? I don't know. And I did what most people do. I literally launched this snake up into the air and ran up the bank screaming, snake, to my mum. My mum is quite far away. She sort of stood up and went, are you okay? And I got to the top of the bank and I realised, that was amazing. What have I done? No, sorry, I'm saying to my mum, no, I'm fine. And I go back down to the bank and I look and I'd heard this splash behind me and I knew the snake had landed in the stream. And the first thing that went through my head is, I've drowned it. And I'm sat there and all remorseful now thinking, oh, you idiot, what have you done? You know, that was the most incredible wildlife encounter and you reacted so ridiculously to it. And I sat back down the bank and I'm reading my Ladybird Book of Dinosaurs and I'm just thinking, oh, you idiot. And it was about a minute later, all of a sudden on the other side of the bank, that she broke cover and she raised her head and went along. And if you've ever seen a grass snake, you know, they've got these beautiful golden collars. She's dipped into the water. So there's, you know, it's almost this emerald green glistening animal, 1.2 meters on the other side of the bank going past, the most majestic thing I'd ever seen in my life. And all I could do, I was looking at my Ladybird Book of Dinosaur, looking up, looking down the Ladybird Book of Dinosaurs, looking back and thinking, I've just found the last refuge of the dinosaur and it's here in South Wales and no one else knows it's here. But wow, what a first adventure, you know, for a first encounter, that was it, because I was literally bitten. Snakes were my thing.
After leaving school with 3 O-levels, Rhys went on to have an array of miscellaneous jobs, being in a band, a spot of professional dancing, working in a tropical fish store, but it was a friend who inspired him to look again at academia.
He said, you know, with all this work you do with animals and everything else, you know, as you say, he was working in tropical fish shops, I was working with exotic animals, exotic pets and whatnot. He said, why don't you go back and read, you know, zoology? And so I looked at all these different opportunities to read a HND in zoology. And it turned out that on the, you know, you get the UCAS form and you fill in all these HNDs and there was one box left over. And I said, well, you know, there's only 5 HNDs I can find. He said, well, put Cardiff University down. I said, they don't do a HND. And he said, but they do a degree. So after I finished, you know, laughing, I just thought, how ridiculous me going in to read a degree. He said, well, you either put it in or you don't put it in. I went, fine, put it in, posted it. And I got sent an invitation by accident, to go to Cardiff University to read this degree, and I haven't got the qualifications to do this.
What do you mean by accident?
Well, they'd assumed that I had an excess course or A-levels, and there was a miscommunication somewhere, so I get sent this invitation to discuss coming to read a degree at Cardiff University, and I turn up there, and, you know, there's full of apologies. I'm so sorry you've turned up, but you don't have the qualifications to be here. I really wanted to prove myself. I had to, you know, they had lots of candidates coming in for a finite amount of places. And I could see my chance to go to university slowly ebbing away because, you know, I could see this guy's eyes glazing over, you know, the admissions tutor.
And by the way, worth pointing out for international listeners, Cardiff University, that's...
It's a Russell Group university.
Yeah, so you're talking top 20 universities in the country.
It is really not easy to get into. It is a top university. And I'm desperately trying to find some way to impress this man. And, you know, the answers I'm given, he's heard them all before. I started to panic. And with dyslexia, if you panic, you start to look for all different information from anywhere, anywhere at all. So you're trying to glean information from anywhere. And as I'm talking to him, there is a fish swimming around on top of his head. And I can clearly see this. I know it's not really there, but it's my dyslexic mind saying, there is something here about fish, fish, fish you need to mention. And I'm thinking, what is this? And slowly as I'm looking over his head, directly behind him, I can see there's his thesis. And I just quickly shout out, Labrachromus, like this. And, and it sounds like a Harry Potter curse or something. And he said, I'm sorry. And I said, it's a Lake Malawi cichlid. And he said, what do you know about Lake Malawi cichlids? I said, you know, the evolution of these cichlids is so interesting. I said, if you're looking at the tidal variation, I said, Lake Malawi, and the way that these animals, you know, these different species are brought together, hybridized, and we've got all these different species of fish now, which have specialized. You've got the algae feeders, you've got predatory fish, you've got the bottom feeders. And sit down. Tell me more about these fish. So I start telling him more and more about these fish and what I know about Lake Malawi cichlids. And what I came to find out was he was sat there at the time thinking, this guy either has the knowledge of a PhD on these animals or he is the world's greatest bullshitter. And I have to find out which he is. So basically found up another admissions tutor to come in. And the other admissions tutor was a specialist in cichlids, in this particular African fish. And he came and sat in on this conversation, looked over at the other doctor, nodded his head and went, you know, like, yeah, he knows his stuff.
How did you know your stuff about Lake Malawi cichlids?
I had just, you know, gleaned all this information when I was working with exotic pets and exotic fish. And of course, in the shops, they've got a book stand. And in that book stand, there's all the information you could ever want to know about these different fish. And I, you know, in spare moments would take these books.
Yeah, but it must have taken you a long time as someone who struggled with reading.
Yeah, but I was so interested in everything. You know, there was no downtime for me. I wouldn't sit there and just, I'll just sit here with a cup of tea and not do anything. I had to, you know, I was like a sponge. I needed to take in all this information. And all of a sudden, all this information, seemingly useless information, was now being regurgitated and it could be the route to get me into university. So when I became an undergraduate, you know, you've got to think about some way of making money. You could do some demonstrating, this type of thing, but that was much later on. So when you're, you know, a lowly undergraduate at the beginning, it's either sort of flipping burgers or finding something that you're better at than anyone else than you can make money at. For me, it turned out that I was rescuing lots of different snakes from lots of different avenues. And because I had these snakes, I knew all about them. People like to listen to me talking about them.
Hold on, I started doing
snake talks.
Did you have snakes in the lab at the university then? Is that how you came to be the person who goes and rescues snakes?
No, that would have been an obvious and sensible approach. No, these snakes all lived with me. So I had lots and lots of different tanks from my pet shop days. And I'd fit up those aquariums so that we could house the different snakes. So the police, for instance, if they found an escaped snake, they would contact me at the university and say, hey, Reese, we found another snake, over to you. And I just end up looking after all of these snakes.
Okay, so you're like a crazy cat lady, but for snakes.
Crazy cat lady, but for snakes. And at one point, I had 70 snakes.
In your flat?
Yeah, but all of these, you know, this is not some type of crazy collection. This one has escaped. this person is not treating the snake correctly. You know, I even had snakes that people had tried, you know, obviously you've got to keep snakes warm, okay, they're ectothermic animals, and I'd had snakes that had, where the heating elements in the tanks hadn't been properly protected, and the snake had tried to warm itself next to the heating element and had stuck to it. And I'd have to go in and cut it slowly out with a razor blade to get it out. Well, you know, that animal then needs to be rehabilitated and looked after and nursed back to health. These are all the things I'm doing. So, yeah, crazy cat lady in a way, but all of the animals needed saving. You know, they wouldn't survive out in the wild. They would have died.
But it's pure hobby. I mean, you're studying zoology, but actually you're not studying snakes. You just keep snakes for fun.
Absolutely. So I've just got all of these different snakes that I'm keeping. I can remember one time in particular where I got called in with the police. I used to be on the warrants, I should say, as well, you know, and often the first or one of the first people through the door, and you get into a flat and you may have a drug dealer there saying, yeah, great, you know, my stash of drugs is directly under that snake there. That snake is deadly. Good luck. And they get away with it, you know, because the police would normally say, well, I don't know if that's I'm not trained to know if that's a deadly snake or not.
Right.
So I'll just leave it there. But of course, somebody like myself comes in and I say, actually, it's not a deadly snake. I'll go move it now. And of course, even if it's not a deadly snake, it could be a snake that is really, really afraid. And, you know, if you're not experienced with snakes, if you've got a snake which is striking the glass, you could think that's aggression and not fear. And so, you know, you're not going to put your hand in the tank for fear of being bitten, whereas somebody like myself can come in, calm the animal down, and help the police recover that drug stash.
How do you calm a snake down that, for whatever reason, is appearing to be agitated?
Well, if something is striking the glass, if a snake is striking the glass, normally what happens is somebody is banging that glass. Snakes listen with their entire body. Their entire body is a listening organelle, if you will. So they're very sensitive to noise, quick movements, darty movements. You know, they're catching mice and rats, which move very quickly. So if something moves in front of them, they strike. So you have to do the opposite of that. Slow movements, very gentle, reassure the animal. If the animal can feel that it's safely being picked up and handled, you're calming the animal down. And that's the type of thing that I would do. Then I would put it probably somewhere dark. So maybe, you know, if I've got a pillowcase or something with me, or if it's a bigger snake, I might have to take a continental quilt cover and pop the animal into that and cover it. Keep it calm, keep it dark, and just get it away from that stressful situation.
So did you start with one that was a pet?
Yeah, I started with one that I was looking after from the pet shop. And then from there, we'd have snakes that would come in. The people would come into the pet shop and say, hey, I've got this snake. I don't know what I'm doing with it. It's ill. I just need someone to look after it. Okay, we'll do that. And then because I had a reputation for doing that, then the police would start to contact me and say, hey, do you know what, we go into different houses, and if we've got, you know, sometimes those houses, we find tanks with a snake still left in there and we don't know what to do with it, can we bring it to you? Yeah, great. And then it was rescuing snakes alongside the police. And
so had they developed behavioral issues, these snakes, as a result of that, like a dog or a cat might?
Yeah, so you know yourself, you know, you get people that have so-called aggressive dogs. Most of the time, all of the time, really, it's because that dog has experienced some type of traumatic experience or has been taught by the owner that is doing good. You're doing good by being aggressive like that. Now, if you frighten a snake, and you can frighten a snake, it will defend itself by gaping and striking. It's not an aggressive snake. It's a scared snake.
How do they all interact with each other?
So they weren't in the same tank, should add that.
They're looking at each other.
Yeah, they've got lots of different tanks. Well, I'd separate off most of them, so they couldn't see each other. And snakes are not, their eyesight's not brilliant. They're mostly seeing the world around them from a sort of more olfactory view. So they're smelling and tasting the world around them, whereas you and I use our eyes. So we're in a studio at the moment. If I put my hands over your eyes and said, walk into the studio, you would have been very apprehensive. You really wouldn't have been steady on your feet or happy to walk forward, because your whole world is created from what you can see. For a snake, most of it, they've got eyesight, but it's like almost like a fixed focal eyesight, if you will. So basically, if you're in perfect focus for a snake, you're at the perfect distance to strike.
What do you feed 70 snakes? Did you just have a freezer full of mice?
Not far off, actually. I had lots of mice and lots of chicks as well, day-old chicks. So
alive?
No, not alive. So these are all in the freezer. I don't feed any of my reptiles live animals. You know, if you've got, obviously, a mouse or a chick or something else, first of all, the last thing I want to do is feed another live animal to another animal. That's wrong. But also because, you know, and people don't think of this, if you're feeding a live mouse to a snake, the mouse is not just going to sit there. It's going to protect itself.
Yes.
And it can easily go and bite the snake.
Right.
And it happens a lot. And of course, that snake can actually die from septicemia. So, you know, a bite from a rat or a mouse is really nasty. So I'd transport the snakes. If you think about it, people think it's cruel. I used to transport them in pillowcases. But actually, if you've got no arms and no legs, it's like a little hammock. So it's actually the nicest, most comfortable way to transport these animals. And I could think of one situation where that all fell to pieces. It became a nightmare, actually. So this is in Techniquest in Cardiff. So this is a science centre that we've got, which teaches young people all about science, and you have all these different experiments and whatnot. It's a wonderful, wonderful place, all science and technology. And they'd said, would you come down and give us a snake talk? Introduce all of the children there to different snakes and everything. I went, well, this is fabulous. You know, I've got to do this. Great. So the morning, I'm there bagging up the snakes, and I'm putting in all the different tanks, and I'm labelling them and making sure. And I had a flatmate at the time, John his name was. I said to John, right, I've got to do this now. You know, I'm going to go over the numbers again and make sure that we've got all the right snakes and all the right bags. And, you know, because there's children there, I just don't want to do anything that's wrong. You know, it's a great opportunity. And I managed to get down to Techniquest, and I put the snakes out in the different bags ready to go. And the manager came up. She said, Reece, she said, I've got to ask you, is there anything we should be aware of here? Is there any dangerous snake? And I said, well, the only dangerous one we'd have is the bull snake, because that can really bite. That can give a really nasty bite. And that's in bag three. And so we looked over, and there's no bag three. Bag three is missing. Every other bag is there apart from bag three. And I can just feel my heart in my mouth, and I just go into panic. And they say, do you know where bag three is? No. This snake must have got out, and it, you know, it's dragged the bag with it. So we don't panic. We get all the children together. We evacuate the entire centre. So there's 50-odd people outside now with all the children and everything else. People are brought in. Where could the snake have gone? I'm looking around, you know, every little nook and cranny, and then we see an air conditioning system.
Oh, God.
We start to take the air conditioning system away. My phone is ringing. I'm not answering my phone. I'm sorry, but way too busy. So we undo the air conditioning system. We try, you know, look up the vents. Is it on the roof? Send people onto the roof. We're looking around. We're panicked. My phone is still going. I haven't got time to answer my phone at the moment. We've just got to get on with this. So this carries on. It starts to get to a level where I am literally in need of Valium or something. I am really, really not dealing with this well. My phone is still ringing. Oh, for goodness sake. Hello. Hi, Reece, it's John. John, what do you want, mate? I'm sorry, there's an emergency. He went, just to let you know, he said, you've left bag three in the tank in the house. Oh, my God. No. Now I've got to turn around and tell the manager that, you know, we've just evacuated the entire centre for nothing. So I walk up to her and say, I'm so sorry. The snake is back at the house. And she went, my God, it found its way back to the house. And I just didn't have the heart to tell her it wasn't a homing pigeon, you know.
Still to come, Reece takes his passion for snakes onto television, to Africa, and to a terrified woman's bathroom. Plus, what to do if you see a snake in the wild. That's when the modern man returns. After this. This is a paid advertisement for BetterHelp. You know, man fans, when I go and interview the people that we bring to you in these middle features, whatever they've been through, actually, I'm often struck that many of them haven't talked in this level of detail about their thoughts and feelings very often before. And I can see in front of me the benefit of just talking something through. Now, I'm not a registered therapist, but I do think my experiences of having these sorts of intimate conversations has really changed how I feel about whether or not in my life I might reach out to a professional with credentials. Because in my marriage, in my career, in my relationship with my kids, the path forward isn't always entirely clear. Well, at BetterHelp, they offer convenient real-time therapy sessions online, so you can fit it in whatever you're doing. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. And they've got a special offer for you Man fans. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/man. That's betterhelp.com/MANN. Back to my conversation with Dr. Rhys Jones now, whose exploits rescuing snakes from around South Wales caught the eye of the BBC.
I had just started filming a television programme called Rhys Jones's Wildlife Patrol, and it started to get really big because it was shown at prime time on BBC One between The One Show and EastEnders.
Right.
So this is a huge programme. I remember a couple contacting the police saying that they'd seen a snake, one that had obviously disappeared from somebody else's house, a pet. So the police called me. We've got this escape snake. They have no idea what this snake is. And of course, the snake could be a dangerous snake. It could be somebody's pet, but it may not be. And apparently the way it was moving was not a native species. So, right, we go down. And the last place that this person had seen it was in their bathroom, and they were adamant it was in the bathroom. And I have no idea how this escalated the way it did, but we just started ripping their bathroom out. We ripped out their entire bathroom. The bath came up, the side panels, everything else. And eventually, we found the snake. The snake dropped down and I grabbed it. It was a corn snake, but you know, beautiful white corn snake. I was like, great, we've got it, brilliant. And it was a bit like Team America, you know, with outside of the end of it. Brilliant, we've won, and the, you know, there's no more Paris, they flattened it. It was a bit like that. So we got the snake and we go, thanks everyone. So we leave and the bathroom is just destroyed. We've used sledgehammers to, you know, break through some of the wall. We've taken the bath, but there was nothing left of it at all. But we've got the snake. So, yeah, that escalated very quickly. But
these are residents that didn't own the snake, didn't know where the snake had come from.
They had no idea
and
where
so
the snake
a corn
came.
Snake, what is that? Oh, that would have been an escape pet, would it?
Yeah, it's a type of rat snake. It's an escape pet. So basically, this poor lady got up in the middle of the night to use the loo, went down to the loo, and the lid was down, and curled up on top of the lid. There's the snake.
I mean, other people, not you, would find that terrifying. Would they be wrong to feel that way? I mean, is the snake more scared of you than you are of it?
Absolutely. The snake was terrified. It had no idea where it was and just wanted to hide somewhere and just find somewhere it could go that was safe. But of course, you know, if you've never seen a snake before...
And you're about to lower your trousers, that's
absolutely,
pretty...
Absolutely,
yeah.
You know, it's
you're going to be feeling pretty vulnerable.
Absolutely, I would have thought so.
When you used to capture them, how... I mean, beginner's guide, did you pick them up?
Now, this is interesting because apparently, as a dyslexic, I pick up on lots and lots of little micro-behaviours. So I can remember, actually, we had some copperheads we were moving once, and without thinking I'm just moving the copperheads, I know the ones I can move, I know the ones I can't move. I can see the ones that are stressed and I shouldn't interact with. And I can remember doing this, I can remember somebody coming in and saying, how the heck do you know what you can move and what you can't move? And I went, well, it was obvious. And I thought, everybody can do this. Everybody can see. You know, so when I hand ladders in the wild all the time and still do to this day on a professional context. So I don't go picking up animals when there's no need to. But if I'm moving them, it's something called translocating them professionally from an area, for instance, where a new road is being built or a new housing development is being established, and there's going to be a conflict with those wild animals, I'm normally brought in and can you move these animals? And I know where I can just gently go and pick up and move on. And that isn't obvious to everybody.
And honestly, you credit dyslexia as being able to spot what you can and can't do, a sort of sixth sense when it comes to snakes.
I think that I will go as far as to say that we are definitely picking up on a lot of micro behaviours. I work in Africa and I've had encounters with wildlife that are just extreme and just incredible, and that other people just don't seem to have. One of my favourite encounters, actually, was I'd been trying to work with the Maasai in Eastern Africa, in Kenya, for a long time. And the Maasai, they like who they like. This is the real Maasai. I'm not talking about the ones that you see selling you beads in the Maasai Mara. I'm talking about the real thing up in the Loita regions. And for years, I'd been working in Eastern Africa. I'd been running a field course for the university in Eastern Africa. And we tried to take a photograph of the Maasai, and they would turn away at the last moment, so you never got a face on photograph, you know, this type of thing.
I mean, incidentally, I mean, I understand sort of anthropologically why it's interesting to be around them, but did they appeal to you as people because they have a kind of instinctive relationship with wildlife as well? Is that the thing you were interested in?
What fascinated me was they had lots of wildlife around them, but they didn't eat any of that wildlife. So they herd their own cattle, and they wear bells around their thighs. And the reason being, if they see a lion, quite famously, what they'll do is walk forward, slam their leg into the ground, the bells ring, and they will just face off this lion.
Yeah.
And it is the most incredible thing to see.
And so they tend not to get eaten by the wildlife as well as not eating it themselves.
They are not afraid of anything.
Yeah.
Apart from snakes.
Right.
They are terrified of snakes.
Snakes in Kenya are different to Cardiff, though, I'm guessing.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit, yeah. Yeah. I think we can say that. You know, they're deadly. And so I'd made this firm relationship with the Maasai over a number of years, and then I was invited to the village, and I'm on my absolute best behaviour. I don't want to do anything that's going to upset the Maasai. This is such an honour. I was the only person, you know, with white skin anywhere in that area. I was going to stand out like a sore thumb anyway. I just wanted to be as respectful and grateful and humble as I could be going into that village. It was really, really special to me. And I went down with two Maasai friends now, two Maasai that I'd known for a couple of years. And they took me down to the village, and there were a couple of people eyeing me up suspiciously. And when I got into the middle of the village, all of a sudden I started to see women running, screaming, picking up their children, running all directions. Then some of the Maasai warriors running a different... What is going on? And then right in the middle of the village, I can see a forest cobra, which has clearly taken a wrong turn. And it's going through the middle. It's hooded up, and it's going through the middle of the village. And I instinctively... run towards it. Everyone's running away from it. I just run towards it.
About Maasai the Maasai.
Exactly. Picked up a stick, put it under this cobra and picked it up. Went, oh, there we go. I've got it. I've got it safe. Turned to face the Maasai, and I've lost the two Maasai warriors I was with. I am now faced by a group of Maasai warriors that have no idea who I am, all with drawn knives, all looking at me, you know, literally with daggers. And I'm now thinking, what is going on? They want to kill the snake because, you know, that's what they would normally do. I've got to save the snake. I've got to get out of here. And I just run. And it's twilight. It's you know, the sun is going down. And I'm running off into the wild with this cobra on a stick, full pelt. And these guys are following me, first of all, because they just don't understand what I'm doing. And eventually keep running. And I can hear a hyena. I can hear a lion. I just keep running with this cobra on a stick. Eventually, I realize no one is following me. Get to some scrub, some bushes and some trees, and I put the cobra up into the tree, and it just takes off gently. You know, there's no aggression whatsoever. It just wanted out of that area.
How long is a forest cobra?
It's a couple of metres. It's a big snake.
Kind of thing does it eat?
You know, small mammals and whatnot. The venom would be no good to use on a person because they're not going to eat that person. It's only for defensive means. And then if it's used the venom on you, it can't use it to eat. So, you know, as long as that animal doesn't feel upset, it realised that I was trying to get out of the area. I managed to get up in a tree and it slid off.
What a snake realises?
But it's just, again, those
micro
behaviours.
How do you know what a snake is thinking?
You know, those micro behaviours. You can see it's not being aggressive. You can just see it just generally, you know, thanks for getting me out of this place. I mean, that's a little bit of a, you know, you can be anthropomorphic about it, but it is genuinely, you could see the snake was not being aggressive. It had stopped hooding. It literally just wanted out, and I managed to get it out.
But that's the thing I think that people find particularly freaky about snakes, isn't it? You know, if people list the animals they are afraid of, snakes are often up there, and it's because they seem unreadable compared to mammals. They do seem like, I don't know what that thing's thinking, so I'm scared of it.
It's also how that thing's moving. So if you've got a dog or you've got a cat, it's got four legs, you know how that's going to move, and it'll walk towards you. You see a spider, you see a snake, wow, this organism doesn't move how I'm used to it moving. I can't anticipate how it's going to move. Oh, and all of a sudden, you're afraid of it because you can't anticipate. You don't know what the safe parameters are for you. And that's where people become afraid and become, you know, they get phobias about these animals because they can't predict the movement and how these animals may or may not interact with them.
If you see a snake out and about this summer here in the UK, what should you do?
If you're in the UK, it's going to be one of three species. So basically, if you're looking at a snake that runs away from you at great speed, it's probably a grass snake. That poses no harm to you whatsoever. Just smile and you've witnessed something wonderful because, you know, not many people see them. If it's a snake that stands its ground, it's got a little triangular head with a black markings down its back, or dark brown markings if it's a female, it could be an adder. They are not going to chase you down. They are not going to aggressively jump at you or come out of trees or anything else. They are literally just going to stand their ground. That is what they hope. They hope that you haven't seen them, that they're highly cryptic in that environment, that you're going to walk on by and leave them be. If you've got a dog with you or something, make sure that dog's on the lead or just kept away from them. That's what they'll be afraid of, because to the snake, all it sees is an aggressive animal with teeth that could eat it. And that's why they will defend themselves. Keep the dog out of the way of the conflict. Also, an adder bite is very, very dangerous for a dog. It can kill a dog. So keep dogs, keep your pets out of conflict with the adder. And just walk on by. It will not chase you. It will not come anywhere near you. There's no harm at all there. But it is an incredible sight, something wonderful to see.
I mean, as someone who loves snakes and who's demonstrated snakes and who's kept pet snakes and who's worked selling pets that are exotic, what's your view really on whether they should be pets at all? Because if they're rescue animals, it's sort of easy to explain why you have them. Someone else who was irresponsible doesn't have them, so I have them. But wouldn't it be better if people didn't keep pet snakes at all?
Yes. So when I was younger, I never thought that I would be going to university, that I would have an opportunity to explore Eastern Africa and see these incredible animals in the wild. And having that window, have it, you know, in touch in distance, to be able to communicate, to handle, to be as one with these animals was something incredible to me. But in hindsight now, the last thing that I would want to do is import animals from the wild. I would not want to take young snakes away from their mother, you know, in Africa, which happens all the time, and take eggs away. And
is that how most pet stores get them? They're not bred.
Most pet stores now will breed. You know, that's great if you have responsible owners, and there are a lot of responsible owners out there. There's a lot of very knowledgeable, responsible owners out there. Equally, there are a lot of people that just fancy having a snake in their living room, and it is an accessory. It's a talking point, and it's nothing more. Those are the people that I would not like to see with those animals.
It's also kind of fashionable, I presume, right? It comes in trends. I know that, for example, when the Harry Potter movies came out, exotic animal sales went up.
I can remember writing an article about Hedwig the owl, and saying, please don't go out and buy owls. Loads of people are buying owls. I want an owl. I want an owl. And then, of course, later on in the Harry Potter series, you've got Nagini, the huge Burmese-type python. Everyone goes out and buys a giant Burmese python. It is purely a fashion accessory and a trend and a fad.
But owls and snakes can live for 20 years, right?
Well, exactly. That's the point. So, you know, you're not getting something which is just going to, you know, last as long as the Harry Potter franchise. You're investing in an animal, especially with a big snake, that's going to last probably a third of your lifetime. And what are you going to do when you go on holiday? What are you going to do if you're a young person asking to keep one of these as a pet? Are you going to university? And if so, you're probably not going to be able to take it to your halls of residence. So, who's looking after it then? What are you doing then? And it's not just a case of, oh, well, I'll get rid of it then. You know, you invest in an animal like that. You don't just pass it on. You know, you've taken responsibility. That's the way it is.
And just to return to the story of the lady who found a snake on her loo in the middle of the night, what is the correct reaction there?
Okay, so the correct reaction is not to overreact. Take a breath, step back. It is probably just...
Call you. I mean, I've got your number, so it's fine.
No, but just take a breath, step back. It's probably somebody's escape pet, and this happens much more often than you think it does. So, if you happen to have your phone with you, or you had your phone on you, take a photograph. It helps me to ID exactly what we're dealing with and how quickly I need to get out to you. And just close the door and walk away, okay? If it's a bathroom or another room, the snake is not going to be wanting to move around. It wants to find somewhere safe and where it can hide away. If it's already in a room, it's probably going to hide in that room. Somebody like myself can come in then and recover the snake, but don't engage with it yourself.
Dr. Rhys Jones of Cardiff University. If you do see a snake, he says, call your local police. They usually have someone like him on their books who can help out. Rhys's memoir is coming out next month. It's called Becoming Dr. Jones, A Wild Life. I've read it. It's fun. If you enjoyed that interview, I think you'd enjoy his book. So you can pre-order that now. Or indeed, if you're listening after August 2023, then you can buy it now. I've put a link to do that on the blog post for this episode on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, where you can also find a feedback form where you can suggest future guests for this middle feature section of the show. We don't have time to reply to every email. I promise we read them all. Up next, how can cancer treatment affect your sex life? And what can you do about it? That's The Foxhole with Alex Fox after this. It's time for The Foxhole, your sex questions answered with Alex Fox. What have you been up to?
Well, actually, it's less what I've been up to and more what a company called Roam have been up to. They're a really great brand who do a lot of stuff that I admire. I've brought a few bits and bobs for you to
It looks like cosmetics. Roam, I thought, was going to be like, 4G roaming, but on your knob or something. but actually, these are tasteful cosmetics. I'm going to guess lubricant.
I think they would be over the moon that you described them as looking like cosmetics. The brand was actually founded by two guys who used to work for L'Oreal. And they've tried to make one of their incentives, if you will, one of their overarching aims as a company is to try and make things like lubricant more sort of high-end and desirable.
That's
something
it.
That you might want to have unashamedly on your bedroom shelf.
These look like bottles of miniatures that you might get in a posh hotel. So to be clear, it is lubricant. And you've given me a range here. Some of them are very specific. For the front, for the back, for masturbation.
That phrasing, for the front, for the back, is part of Rome's campaign to try and be more inclusive. So rather than saying for your vagina, which might not apply to people of different gender identities.
Doesn't apply to me, Alex. I'm not afraid to say it.
You do have a back, though. So you might want to...
I also have a partner with a vagina, so it would indeed apply to me, wouldn't it?
And you can apply it to their vagina if you wish. They've got Braille on those bottles as well to make them accessible to visually impaired people. But it's this new product here that I've given you that I'd like you to take a look at. That's something for you to unwrap and a question for our listeners to unravel. And this is a query that I particularly would like to put to any of our audience who are not Caucasian.
Okay, this is interesting. Yeah, so there are a range of condoms that look slightly upmarket, but nonetheless, packet of Johnnies, really, three in each box. But alongside the usual disclaimers, regular fit, ultra thin, it has skin tone. So there's one that says skin tone light brown, one that says skin tone dark brown, one that says original latex. Is that what white people wear? Because my knob's not grey. And one that says medium brown.
Hold on, necrophiliacs, your time will come. That's exactly the point. They've made this range of four different skin-toned condoms, which they say will make people of different races and heritages feel more seen and more catered to in the bedroom and allow them to have, as Rome say, an experience with a condom that both feels and looks invisible. The queries I have about this are, firstly, whether people of colour have ever felt, really, that the condom industry has given them done them a disservice or not catered to them.
They usually see-through, right? Well, so you can see their skin colour through it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Pale coloured condoms aren't pale in order to cater to a white audience.
Yeah.
They're pale because that is just the natural colour of latex. I'd just like to know whether people feel that this is a product that makes them feel less erased, or whether it's a rubber which, much like its fellow namesake, the company might want to erase in the future, because I think some people may even accuse them of just trying to make cash.
Monetize.
Yeah.
Time for your questions of sex now. And this month's is from a 34-year-old lady who wishes to remain anonymous, who says, I've recently been diagnosed with rectal cancer. Luckily, we found it early and it is localized. However, the radiation therapy, chemotherapy and surgery will have a big impact on my life. So, Alex, do you have any tips on how, as a heterosexual woman, I can continue to have a healthy sex life with the short and long-term effects that I will most likely experience? Vaginal scarring, early onset menopause, fatigue.
Matey bubbles. I am just really sorry that you're facing this. Let's just get it out of the way first and say this is shitty. This is shittier than a Glastonbury toilet on day 3. Colorectal cancer, which encompasses cancer of the colon, the rectum and the bowel, is the fourth most common cancer in the UK. 41,000 new cases are diagnosed every year. Of those, though, 94% tend to be in people over the age of 50, and the vast majority are in people aged 70 or over. So even though there is quite a large contingent still of young people being diagnosed, this might be why we don't hear so much talk about the effects of this particular cancer on your sex life and maintaining intimate relationships. Now, Ollie, I wonder whether a lot of people are probably listening going, well, for fuck's sake, fucking is going to be very low down your list of worries when you're going through treatment for cancer. Why are we talking about this? Why is it important?
Well, it's a hell of a corrective, isn't it? Often when you're feeling down, that's one way to feel better, isn't it?
Precisely. Lots of people going through health issues really crave that kind of comfort and connection with another person.
I've had conversations with men who have said that they'd consider postponing cancer treatment because they were worried about impotence, for example. I mean, when younger people get cancer, it's natural that their sex life might be one of the things they're thinking about and how it might affect them.
Absolutely. And what you've just said illustrates perfectly why we need to talk about this more. The fear of how something that profound and with such an enormous impact on your life is going to affect you sexually could actually be putting people off seeking the medical help that they need. Thankfully, there are charities out there like Trekstock, which are specifically aimed at younger people who are going through cancer. They've got a whole series called Lifting the Lid on Cancer and Sex, where they talk not just with experts, but also with people who have gone through this and have first-hand lived experience of what it's like. I spoke to a few of those. Firstly, a brilliant woman called Nat Woodward. Now, before I share some of what Nat told me, I need to make it really clear, and Nat made it clear to me, that unfortunately her experience of colorectal cancer, and she was diagnosed with it at the age of 36, her experience really was the most abysmally difficult end of how these things can pan out. She really wanted to underline the fact that her experience is hopefully not what our listener will go through.
No two bodies are the same, don't know when they caught the cancer, etc.
No.
But what did she have to recommend on these
issues? Well, her first number one recommendation was to use dilators during your radiation therapy. So our listener mentioned vaginal scarring. It's extremely uncomfy. During the healing process, you are encouraged to use dilators. We've mentioned these on the show before when we've been speaking about treatment for things like vaginismus or trans people who are going through gender confirmation surgery. They're little probes, if you will, that are designed to stop the vaginal canal closing in on itself and kind of adhering to itself as the scars form and as it heals. And Nat told me she really hated using them, but she regrets not using them more. In her own words, she said, I felt really unwell. The last freaking thing I felt like doing was shoving a tube inside my vagina. But she and several other women I spoke to who'd been in very similar circumstances really said that using these dilators It's horrible to have to push yourself through it and push one up there, but it's worth sticking to because they can make your sex life in the future a lot easier. Extra hint, she said, if you are finding that really painful or uncomfortable, you can get a little syringe of something called Instilla Gel, which is a local anaesthetic and antiseptic, which also acts as a lubricant.
Okay, what else did she recommend?
She recommended talking to your partner about how things are going to be really different for a while and also how you might need to take a pause from sex full stop. I think there's a temptation when we're wanting to be optimistic and to cheer people on when they're facing a big challenge like cancer treatment to say, it's all going to be fine, it's going to be great. I actually think it's important to be honest, though, and say, you know what, it might be really crap for a while. And you also might find, as Nat did, that you are so knackered and in quite a lot of pain that it's better to manage both your and your partner's expectations and go, you know what, let's just hit pause for a while on the physical aspects of our relationship. Maybe, you know, you might want to give your partner your blessing to try out some new masturbatory toys or something. But you might need to conserve the smaller amount of energy you have on just concentrating on your well-being and your healing and dealing with your pain for a little while.
And actually that would go for early onset menopause as well, which you mentioned, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Now, menopause can have all sorts of effects upon the body. It can make you feel, it can really affect your moods. It can make you feel very blue and anxious. It can contribute towards vaginal atrophy or extreme dryness. And there's all sorts of lubes that you can get. There's one called Replenz, which was recommended by quite a few people I spoke to. Organic Yes VM, which I've recommended myself in the past. That's also a popular one. With regards to menopause, if you are going through radiation treatment or chemo, you might find that you get radiation-induced menopause that's only temporary.
Right,
and
okay.
Then your periods are restored after your treatment is finished. If you have to go through a more extreme surgery like Nat did, where your ovaries and your womb and the whole shebang is removed, then your menopause is going to be permanent then. In quote-unquote normal situations, where between the ages of around 45 to 55, a woman had gone through menopause, she might be recommended HRT, hormone replacement therapy, to ease some of those symptoms. Unfortunately, that's a little bit more complicated when it comes to cancers, because some cancers essentially are fed by hormones like estrogen. And so taking HRT, although it can alleviate some of your menopause symptoms, it can be way too risky in terms of cancer. Nat has her own opinions on this, and she says she wishes that she'd advocated for herself earlier. Because there was a history of breast cancer in her family, and obviously she already had had several tumours herself, her doctors advised her not to take HRT, but she really, really struggled with this sudden onset of massive menopausal symptoms. And she actually pushed for HRT and said that in her opinion, she'd rather risk the possibility of another tumour than go through what she was going through. She said she used a therapist as well. She said, if you do have access to a psychosexual therapist, all the better. And she also suggested write down all the questions that you have and all the worries that you want to talk about. Because when you have limited time to talk to your specialist, when you run down or whatnot, it can be really easy to forget things. Mm. So taking a moment to write things down
can
be helpful.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Limited time with a specialist. Are you going to prioritise your sex life? No, you're not.
Yeah.
Okay, and you spoke to a third person too.
Yes, I actually spoke to a man fan, Hayley Gullen. Hayley's experience of cancer is a little bit different. She had breast cancer. Again, as a young person, though, she was only 37. She went through 8 rounds of chemotherapy then, surgery and radiotherapy, and that made her menopausal. So she found a hormone therapy called tamoxifen really helped her with vaginal dryness. Again, though, because it's hormonal, it's not going to be suitable for everyone. One of the more bittersweet things that she mentioned was that chemo made her hair fall out, and when she was on top during sex, a lot of her follicles fell in her partner's face. Mm. They were able to laugh about that. Other people might find that really upsetting. Mm. How would you deal with a thing like that?
Incidentally, until you just said that, I've never considered this either, but does that affect body hair too?
Yeah. Your eyebrows can fall out, your eyelashes, your pubic hair. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's another thing to consider, isn't it? Which you just, you know, are not generally hearing in the public conversation around these issues. The thing that she ended her letter with was, what about having sex with a stoma and maintaining body positivity? So she's obviously expecting to have a stoma bag at the end of this.
Uh-huh.
We actually did do an episode, a middle feature with Hannah Witten, the YouTuber, who has a stoma bag and talks about body positivity back in 2018. So you can go on our own podcast feed for a bit of that. The episode's called Stomasexual. but what do you think you can say around this?
First of all, I just think it's really important to recognise that being body positive when you have a stoma and when you're going through cancer and all this massive stack of challenges, it's okay to have days when that doesn't come easily.
Yes.
Like, just be a bit gentle on yourself, expecting yourself not only to get through all of these health problems, but also to be, you know, a barrel of positivity and
I think upbeat
enthusiasm.
It can feel absurd, can't it? To be like, look how sexy my stoma is. No one, literally no one thinks that. But the point is, look how sexy I can be despite this.
Yeah, there's lots of ways of making your stoma less intrusive. I spoke to Charlotte Dawson, who is a nurse who works with Bowel Cancer UK. Charlotte mentioned to me that before you do anything sexual or intimate, it's good to get to know your stoma yourself, how it functions. And if you feel okay about this, let your partner see it.
Mm.
Lots of people have really extreme, gross visualizations in their imaginations of what it must be like to have essentially a bag attached to you that collects your poo, your feces. The reality of stomas aren't usually as bad as people as people conceptualise. Yeah, they're way more discreet. So just like just sharing that visual with your partner and letting them kind of get up close and personal with your stoma before it's getting up close and personal. When it comes to intimacy itself, you can get all sorts of covers for stomas that makes them a bit prettier or sort of camouflages them a bit. You can get caps for them. Lots of people, though, just find that like a cami top or a longer piece of lingerie that covers it up can make them feel a bit more confident and also can sort of help hold everything in place so you're less worried about gurgles and flaps and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Empty your stoma pouch and fit a new one before you get physical with somebody. Charlotte recommended avoiding eating just before having sex, as eating does increase your gut motility.
Mm-hmm.
That's not bad advice, but I would also just add a note of caution there. If you start stressing a lot about how eating might affect your stoma, that can lead quite quickly to disordered eating patterns.
Mm.
And that stress and anxiety can cause issues that you don't need. Also, Hayley mentioned something which I found quite uplifting. She is personally into S&M and wanted to continue that kind of play, which is, you know, if you're into that, that's a great option for non-penetrative, very escapist, very immersive sexual play. It's fabulous. But was worried because she had a PICC line. So she had essentially a tube coming out of her arm that went directly into her arteries. And she didn't want to F with that while she was getting effed. So she had some custom cuffs made by a company called toptobottomleathers.co.uk.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, so they'd be comfy and safe and not interfere with any of the medical equipment that she was using.
Okay, well, lots there to think about. You've got some support links as well, right?
I've got a huge list of resources and facilities and all sorts of things that may be of help, which I'll pop on the Modern Man website.
Yes, so if you go to the blog post for this episode at modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, then all the links will be there. And to the lady that wrote in, all the best to you. We are thinking of you. If you've got a question of sex you would like to ask Alex in a future edition of the show, what do you need to do with it?
It's just another great reason to head over to the Modern Man website. That's modernmanwith2ends.co.uk and hit feedback.
And with that, we've very nearly reached the end of this edition of The Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new ambassador, and it's Darcy in Canada. Darcy, I'm not going to say your last name or where exactly in Canada you're from, because I can tell you like to play it cool.
in terms of your web presence. But thank you so much for supporting this show since 2015, and also for the donations that you've given to Answer Me This and Today in History with the Retrospectors. You are, I think, Ollie Mann's top supporter, so I thought it was about time that I recognised your generous contributions to my career, even though you've never asked me to do so. I now pronounce you Manbassador for people with the 4,116,508th most frequently held surname on Earth, which yours is, apparently. Congratulations. If you'd like to be a Manbassador, buy us a beer, drop us a line. Links are on our website. Until next time, our music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. And we'll be back with the Dads on August the 10th.
Can you hear the voice of the voiceless? Can you see the choice of the choiceless? It's on the wall. Can you hear the call to make a noise for the noiseless? You could be the voice of tomorrow. Fly instead of walking a tightrope. Just make a sound and find your ground and come on out of the shadows. You could be the voice of the voiceless. You could be the voice of the voiceless.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.